From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Ravi Shankar brought Indian music to the West, his great sitar to the world. He shaped global pop, inspired jazz, built bridges. The godfather of world music, as the Beatles' George Harrison famously put it. Shankar died this week at 92. His music definitely did not. This hour on Point, we're remembering the great sitar virtuoso who spanned continents and cultures, Ravi Shankar. You can join the conversation. Did Ravi Shankar open up the world to you? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. And you can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. In a few minutes, we'll be joined by Kardik Seshadri, renowned sitar player and musical disciple of Ravi Shankar, and by the legendary conductor Zubin Mehta, who worked with Shankar and knew him well. But first, from Hounslow, England, Ken Hunt joins us, music critic, broadcaster, lyricist, and Ravi Shankar's approved biographer. Ken Hunt, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom.
You knew Ravi Shankar for a long time. How long? When did you first make contact?
The first time I met him formally was when I interviewed him in 1992, and down the succeeding years I interviewed him on many occasions, including a long stint with him at his home in Ensenada.
Ken, describe the instrument that he brought to the world in so many ways. It's behind us right now with this wonderful tune, Gat Kirwana, the sitar, 6 melody strings that are plucked, 25 sympathetic strings played. Not played, but resonate freely. Just paint a picture of this for people who haven't seen the sitar, this instrument that Ravi Shankar so mastered.
Well, the instrument's a long-necked lute with a resonating body on the right-hand side of the instrument as the instrumentalist mm-hmm. plays it, and sometimes with a gourd at the other end, the peg end, which is either functional or non-functional. And of course, one of the things that Ravi Shankar did was he brought new technology to the instrument. So what had begun life as a folk instrument called the sitar in the Persian area became the sitar that we now know.
And we know this instrument in no small part because Ravi Shankar brought it over. And I want to drop a piece of music right here that looms so large in this story, even though it has nothing to do with the musicianship or the playing of Ravi Shankar. But this is kind of one of those East-West moments, and he does come into the picture. Norwegian Wood by the Beatles, 1965. George Harrison on the sitar. John Lennon on vocals from the 1965 album Rubber Soul.
She wanted me. She showed me her room. Isn't it good? Norwegian wood.
The Beatles, giant in 1965, and the sitar right in the middle of that song. Ken Hunt joins us from England. We got a Fox News web headline Wednesday morning after Ravi Shankar's death. Beatles sitar player Ravi Shankar dies at 92, but of course he was not Ken. George Harrison had kind of tracked this down on his own. He later studied sitar with Ravi Shankar. But in many ways, Ravi Shankar was building the bridge that opened the entire West to seeing, hearing this music. Was he not, Ken?
He was. And of course, it was some Americans who introduced George Harrison and John Lennon to the music of Ravi Shankar. And they were David Crosby and Jim McGinn of the Byrds, who played them some of the music in August 65 when the Beatles were out in Los Angeles.
Yeah. And of course they knew because Ravi Shankar was out in the world. We're going to look at the really interesting story of this man, dead at 92 this week, a great musician whose early life had so much to do with bringing this music across. Got a little bit here from a 1971 documentary, Raga, about the life and music of Ravi Shankar. He's coaching the Beatles' George Harrison in sitar playing here. There's strumming you can hear in the background. Shankar narrates the scene.
Raga. da 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 da.
It is strange to see pop musicians with sitars. I was confused at first. It had so little to do with our classical music. When George Harrison came to me, I didn't know what to think. But I found he really wanted to learn. I never thought our meeting would cause such an explosion, that Indian music would suddenly appear on the pop scene. It's peculiar.
Ravi Shankar talking about the Beatles, George Harrison, and sitar Indian music suddenly exploding in the pop scene, and boy, did it ever. He would later, after big appearances at the Monterey Pop Festival, at Woodstock, the concert for Bangladesh, he was in the heart of that, and more, he would turn his back on that rock scene. Ken Hunt is the approved biographer of Ravi Shankar. Take us back to where he came from, his family, how he got started in music. It wasn't initially even the player of an instrument. He was a dancer with his very well-known brother.
Well, he was born in April 1920 in Varanasi, which is a holy city for Hindus,
mm-hmm.
on the banks of the Ganga, the Ganges.
Mm-hmm.
And he was the seventh of seven children. Most of the obituaries have got that wrong. There were some deaths in the family, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
His father was a minister for a Maharaj, a gifted man, a learned man, in the wrong marriage. And for a lot of time, he was away from his wife. So he would come back to the marital home, produce a child, and then disappear again. And so Ravi, as he is now known, Robu as he was then,
mm-hmm.
Was brought up by his mother. The same year that he was born, 1920, his father disappeared to work abroad, eventually in London. And that same year, his eldest brother, Uday, who was 19 plus years, almost 20 years his senior, also went to London, in his case, to study pictorial art. Whilst Uday was in London, he was something of an exotic creature, extraordinarily handsome man, fine-featured, and he managed to inveigle his way into the Pavlova Dance Company, where he became a choreographer and dancer. And he was, it cannot be overestimated, a heartthrob.
And toured the world eventually with Ravi in his company as a dancer. We have some of that sound, Ken. This is from 1937, a way back track. This song is Raga Bharava. Bharava, performed by the original Uday Shankar, Ravi's brother, a company of Hindu musicians. Young Ravi participating in the number. Got that way back sound, Ken. And then the all-important Baba Aluddin Khan comes into Ravi's life as part of this company and says, get serious, young man. They've traveled the world, toured, and performed all over. He says, come home to India, make a commitment, a musical commitment to the sitar. And Ravi Shankar does. Where did he do the study that ensued, Ken?
Well, I would generally call him Panditji, so if I call him Panditji, forgive me. Pandit is just a teacher, and ji is a suffix denoting respect. Panditji had been based in Paris and had managed to go around the world. And this was in an era when very few people would have traveled. And he had gone to all over Europe. He had traveled in the United States. He'd got to Hollywood, where he tried to get himself adopted by a Hollywood family. And he'd seen the fine life, as very few people of that era would have done. In July 1938, he renounced that. He cut off all his hair and went to visit the man who was to be his guru, Alauddin Kansab, in what would be considered quite primitive circumstances, very basic.
Back in India, obviously.
In India, yes, in Maihar. Mm-hmm. And he told me how it was full of creepy crawlies where he was living, snakes and lizards. But then if you're in a house in India and you haven't got a gecko, you really aren't living.
But he did the hard work there. He said his guru killed his ego, told him to commit to the discipline of the music. He certainly did. And when he came back after that global experience and then that investment in serious musicianship, well, it really changed the world in many ways. Ken Hunt, please stand by. In England, we're talking about the great Ravi Shankar, dead this week at 92. Here's his Raga Jog, first released LP, three ragas, 1956. Forgive me, this is Fire Night, jazz-infused, 1961, Leaping Head. We'll be back with more of Ravi Shankar's music. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour with the great Ravi Shankar, who bridged the music of East and West, brought his sitar and Indian classical music to John Coltrane, the Beatles, the world, died this week at 92. Behind me, Ravi Shankar with legendary violinist Yehudi Menuhin on a cut called Swara Kakali off the 1966 collaborative album West Meets East. A bridge builder like few others, and a giant within the world of his own Indian classical music. Ken Hunt joins us from Hounslow, England, a biographer of Ravi Shankar, approved working on that. You can join us in this hour. Did Ravi Shankar open up Indian music to you many years ago? Do you remember when all that was impossibly remote, exotic, when you first heard sitar, maybe with the Beatles, when you first heard the real thing with Ravi Shankar? Can you imagine what it took to be the pioneer in this, to span these cultures, these traditions? We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. We're going to hear in just a moment from the great Zubin Mehta, who worked with Ravi Shankar, and the renowned sitarist Kartik Seshadra, who joins us from San Diego in a moment as well. Let's go to our listeners first. Bob in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Bob, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hello.
I have a special memory of Ravi Shankar, I think. I'm not certain, and perhaps Mr. Hunt can confirm whether this is so. I believe my father took me to see him play at Club Passim in Cambridge sometime in the late 1960s. Was he in Cambridge then, in the Boston area?
Ken? I wouldn't know. That's Cambridge, Massachusetts,
yes,
I take sir. It.
Yes, yes.
I'm closer to Cambridge, Cambridgeshire in England.
Right. That's what I remember, and every time I hear his name mentioned, I've always had a warm moment because it was such a special experience. My father took us to a lot of different things, and the number of them went over my head, I'm afraid, especially when I was 8, 9, 10 years old. But this was just, I was enthralled the whole time. I was enthralled by the music. I was enthralled by the performers and the instruments they were playing, and most of all by Mr. Shankar and the intensity and the focus and yet also the joy of the way that he played, in the way that he played his instrument.
A musical memory there. I can't vouch for that night at that club, but he certainly toured a lot in the West in his time, and at some very big venues as well. Bob, thanks for your call. Thomas is calling from New Orleans. Thomas, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hey, I have to say that Ravi Shankar had a big influence on me because I saw him for the first and heard him for the first time at Woodstock. And also Ritchie Havens and the two of them really had a huge influence. I mean, I think he did on a lot of people because it really began a spiritual quest for me and a lot of my generation.
You were there at Woodstock and you saw him. That was a big performance. Right. Monterey Pop Festival as well brought him right into the heart of the American pop rock world. Ken Hunt, Ravi Shankar ended up being rather disillusioned, though, looking out on that kind of stoned crowd at Woodstock and elsewhere. I mean, he was excited at Monterey by Otis Redding and the Mamas and the Papas, but when, you know, Jimi Hendrix was lighting his guitar on fire, this was not Ravi Shankar's cup of tea, Ken.
Not in the slightest. He was no fan of hippies if they were off their faces and not really concentrating on what he was doing. He's discussed that with me on a number of occasions. He was genuinely scared by what The Who and Jimi Hendrix did to their guitars. And in fact, earlier in the time when he was getting George Harrison to get used to the sitar, Harrison actually stepped over an instrument and got rebuked for it. That's not something that one does. So the fact that someone was setting light to
right,
a guitar
right.
or destroying one would have been anathema to him.
He eventually pulled back more deeply into classical Indian music to kind of restore his reputation there, though he had opened a bridge that was just incredible. John Coltrane, very much inspired by Ravi Shankar, named his son Ravi Coltrane after him, and many others. Here's a late 90s interview, Ravi Shankar reflecting on his collaboration with the Beatles' George Harrison and talking about what their relationship meant for his Western popularity.
It was something else when George and we got connected in 66. It was like wildfire, you know. And all the younger generation, they rediscovered me. And it was something which I couldn't believe what was happening.
Ravi Shankar on how he just couldn't believe how all of this took off. Ken Hunt, please stand by there in England. With us right now from San Diego, California, is Kartik Seshadri, world-renowned sitarist and musical disciple of Ravi Shankar, music professor, director of the Indian Music Program at the University of California, San Diego. Kartik Seshadri, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks, Tom, for having me. Obviously, it's a very difficult time for me personally, having lost my guru, who I have known for almost 50 years now.
That is a long relationship, and we know it was a deep one. And for you and many others this week, it has been a difficult week. At the same time, we celebrate an unbelievably rich life, and we appreciate your helping us do that. With us as well from Los Angeles, the legendary Indian-born orchestral and operatic conductor Zubin Mehta, currently music director for the Life of the Israel Philharmonic Orchestra, previously served as music director for the New York Philharmonic, the Los Angeles Philharmonic. Zubin Mehta, it's an honor to have you with us. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Hello, Tom. Thank you very much.
Would you be kind enough to describe your collaboration with Ravi Shankar, Zubin Mehta?
Well, I met him for the first time in Los Angeles in the early 60s, and I was so taken after hearing so many records of it to hear him in person of how during the evening of performing, you know, once Indian musicians get warmed up, it takes almost an hour or two,
yeah.
and then they really light up,
yeah.
and the public just, you know, the public takes part, like in a jazz performance also. And I remember his great tabla player, Alla Rakha.
Uh-huh.
And after I heard them, I called some of my jazz musician friends. I said, you must hear this from your point of view. And I called this great jazz drummer. He just couldn't believe what Alla Rakha was improvising in his rhythmic cycles. And then, because, you know, we can't even hardly write down with our system what they in the heat of improvisation conjure up.
Yes, yes.
It was for me as a musician of Western education, absolutely an explosion within me to hear these two great musicians playing. And then, of course, I had recordings of another great Indian musician, Ali Akbar Khan, playing the sarod. And all
yes.
this was for me growing up in Bombay, but only with Western music and hearing Beethoven quartets in my house. It was a revelation in Los Angeles.
we have a recording of those two, Zubin Mehta. Let me play just a little bit here. And Kartik, I want to come to you. But among Ravi Shankar's most important collaborations, those with the renowned classical musician of India, Ali Akbar Khan, here's Raga Palas Kafi, recording of the two off the 1964 album The Master Musicians of India. This, the long build-up. As Zubin Mehta says, they will reach a point where they take off, and then all bets are off. The improvisation is quite incredible. Kartik Seshadri, describe for us, in the West we tend to think, to associate improvisation with jazz and something relatively modern. In this classical Indian tradition, which Ravi Shankar so championed and exemplified, improvisation is an ancient tradition. How does it work, the improvisation in this tradition, Kartik?
Well, for starters, Tom, the track that you're playing is actually not Rag Palas Kafi, but it's a very ancient raga. The name of the raga is Bilas Khani Todi.
Forgive
I think
me.
The record label actually flipped the side and had the wrong label.
No wonder we're confused.
Yes.
Okay.
So, but the opening section in the Indian rendition of a raga begins with a very non-metric sort of what we consider an introspective rendition of the raga.
Mm-hmm.
And that is not a section that incorporates a rhythm in the sense
tabla,
of having a pulse, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
So what you're listening to in this track is this particular raga which was actually supposed to have been created by Bilas Khan, who was the son of Mia Tan Sen, who was one of the legendary figures of Indian classical music. And the whole legacy of Indian classical music sort of begins with him and goes to Wazir Khan Sahib, then, of course, my Guruji's guru, Baba Alauddin Khan Sahib.
Yes.
And then my guru, and then we are all here trying to continue the pure aspects of Indian classical music.
But when it comes to that moment that Zubin Mehta describes to us, and this, as you say, introspective behind us here, but in so many of these performances comes the moment when, after a long introspection, it takes off. Ravi Shankar spoke often of how he loved that improvisation. What's the context for that musically? Is it the kind of free form improvisation of Western jazz improvisation, or is it within a better known mold or form of classical tradition?
Well, it's a very interesting question, because the improvisation in the Indian tradition happens within the very strict parameters of a raga, which is the fundamental tonal idiom for improvisation. And the raga, as you know, is a very complex amalgam of ascending and descending movements and microtonal inflections, ornamentations. And those aspects of the music are what guide the improvisational process. So we are very bound in our improvisation. So we cannot have the kind of liberty, for example, as one may in jazz, to go outside the realm of the raga. We are very bound, and we have to find the freedom within the raga. That is one of the main challenges. Then when the raga progresses to the next dimension, where it is inscribed, if I may, into a rhythmic cycle, the second component of Indian classical music, tala, becomes very important. And this is when the music becomes increasingly electric and fantastic permutations and combinations are worked out just on the spur of the moment. And that is the electricity that you pick up, that instant rapport that you're talking about between the soloist, a sitarist, or a sarod player like Ali Baga Khan Saab, where you see that kind of an explosion and spontaneity playing out.
Western listeners heard that at the Concert for Bangladesh 1971. We've got a little bit of that right here. Rocks in this week when we've had the big charity concert for Hurricane Sandy victims. This was kind of the charity concert like that. The first Harrison got him involved. Two big concerts. This was in a time of the terrible conflict around what was then East Pakistan. Relief efforts for Bangladesh there. Shankar opened up the concert with this traditional dun titled Bangla Dun. And off it would go. Zubin Mehta in Los Angeles. You'll remember a time, this sounds kind of familiar to our ears now after the last several decades, but there was a time when this was so remote and so far from most Western listeners. It seemed as though it required somebody like Ravi Shankar with his unique background and his openness to break this open to the world. George Harrison calls him the godfather of world music. It seems fair, does it not, Zubin?
Well, absolutely, but as our friend in Cambridge just described to us, his youth was so full of a tapestry of different cultures, all interwoven with his growing up with his brother Uday, that this curiosity was in him right from the beginning. His curiosity to learn Western classical music, or to Yehudi Menuhin. And when he wrote the concerto for us for the New York Philharmonic, and he couldn't read or write our system, and he would play little strains of the raga he was going to write for the orchestra on his sitar, and we would take dictation, and we put this 1 hour long piece called Raga Mala to with very painstaking work. And he wrote pseudo improvisations for members of the orchestra,
yes,
who, of course, at every performance played the same improvised thing. And of course, but he would sit with us, and there would be times when he would improvise. And he so wanted to hear the orchestra that he would not play as much at rehearsals. And I said, "Look, we want to hear you improvising." But of course, you know, all this curiosity and his sense of adventure got him into trouble in India too. The purists maligned him, and it hurt me very much that this man who is really striving to learn other cultures and to embody himself within them was not well looked after upon in India. And I'm sure he suffered from that. Also, but he strayed on, and especially when he used to appear on American talk shows, they would never, of course, give him the time to interpret an entire raga. So he would go straight into the exciting part of it, and of course, that's not how it should be.
It's not the whole thing, right? Where's the warm up? Zubin Mehta, you're part of that bridge in your collaboration with Ravi Shankar that we are the great beneficiaries of. It's wonderful to have you with us today. Thank you so much for joining us for a few minutes from Los Angeles. Zubin Mehta, thank you.
Thank you very much.
We're talking about the great Ravi Shankar, dead this week at 92. Just a giant of world music, of building the bridges between cultures that let us hear such wonderful music over so many years. Kartik Seshadri, please stand by in San Diego. Ken Hunt in England. Listeners, you can join us. Indian-American listeners, how do you see Ravi Shankar, his music, his life, his role as a bridge? 800-423-8255 is our number, 800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the great Ravi Shankar, who bridged the music of East and West. You can hear him doing it behind us right here off his 1987 album, Tana Mana, cleverly named tune, West Eats Meat Here. After so many West Meets East, Ravi Shankar having some fun across cultures. Ken Hunt is with us from England, approved biographer of Ravi Shankar with us this hour. Kartik Seshadri is with us from San Diego, California, a disciple of Ravi Shankar and great sitarist in his own right from the University of California, San Diego. You can join us. What did the West hear in Ravi Shankar's music? Did they, we, hear what was really there? And how will you remember Ravi Shankar? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. David's calling from Hampton, New Hampshire. David, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
Yeah, I saw him play in a totally unique concert in Vancouver, British Columbia in 74 with George Harrison's Dark Horse Tour. And it was phenomenal because he not only had Ravi Shankar and Ali Akbar Khan, he had a full Indian orchestra, a woman whose voice sounded like a flute. But the thing is Harrison's backup band was the LA Express, which is a phenomenal band at the time. And the music that night was unbelievable, but the crowd gave Harrison a hard time about having the Indian orchestra because he had them play not just one set, but they played two of the three sets played that night. And the crowd gave him a hard time, and Harrison stood there and he said, "I love that music.
Mm-hmm.
I love that music so much. I die for it." Right, and the crowd just completely quieted after that moment. You know, they saw Harrison's commitment to the Indian music. It was really, really amazing show. The Indian musicians were just.
Yeah, David, I'm so grateful to you for sharing that with us. I mean, Ken Hunt, it was interesting, the expectations from audiences and stage here. There was the famous moment in the concert for Bangladesh where I think Ravi Shankar was just warming up or tuning his instrument. And the crowd went into wild applause, and he was kind of cynical about it. You know, if you think that's great, wait for the real concert. There was so much that these audiences did not know, Ken, about what was going on in the Indian performance.
I'm not sure he was cynical about that. He had a wicked sense of humor.
Maybe that's what it was.
If you spent any time with him, you know, he would do impersonations of great musicians. And one of my cherished moments is him impersonating himself, teaching Peter Sellers how to do a cod Indian accent in the film The Party. And we just cracked up. We actually were crying with laughter.
Yeah.
He had a wonderful sense of humor.
Well, so maybe it was a good quip, but even so, the crowd didn't recognize that he was tuning, not playing.
I'm kind of a bit, so what about that?
Yeah, sure. I'm with you.
I was looking at a website today,
yes,
commenting about an obituary that was written in The Guardian in England,
uh-huh,
and it was clear that even today, lots of people have no idea what it's about, despite all his best efforts to communicate what this was about, this music. And he did it so marvelously because he had the ability to talk so eloquently in English, for a start.
Yes. I mean, and yet we say may have no idea. On the other hand, when you compare awareness and openness today to what it was early in his career, early in his life, there's really no comparison. Ears and minds and hearts so open today to this music.
Exactly. It's been said, I've written it, that the extent of people's knowledge was the 144 square inches on the back of an LP sleeve.
Right.
there was nowhere to go to find out about this music. There were very few comparisons to be made. You know, when Panditji made his first LP in 57 as a soloist, there were very few LPs around. Although he'd appeared on a French anthology in 55. So we really were at the extent of our knowledge. And the first LP that ever came out with him on in 55 in France got the year of his birth wrong.
right,
we,
well.
We, And that's what we had as our gospels.
But step by step, here's a little bit off the 1998 album Raga Jogeshwari, more traditional, classical sound maybe, Alap from Ravi Shankar. Kartik Seshadri in San Diego, talk to us about what's going on in this piece, what it represents.
Well, this piece is one of, I think, one of his hauntingly beautiful alap sections of raga that he created. And it exemplifies a style, a very ancient style of presenting a raga, which is based in Drupad, which is one of the oldest methods of rendering a raga. And that is the style he learned actually from Baba Alauddin Khan Saab. That is the legacy we are talking about, mm-hmm. in a larger sense.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the, as we mentioned earlier, the introspective aspect of Indian classical music, where it begins with the alap, progresses to a section called Jod, where you have a sense of pulse,
mm-hmm.
and then eventually it leads to a movement when you introduce the tala, the rhythmic component, when the tabla joins in,
mm-hmm.
and the music gets further and further. Interestingly, it gets more and more tied down to a beat cycle, but
yes.
paradoxically, it's also getting very open and very exciting
yes.
at the same time. So there's something very interesting happening there. But this is a great example of the real, what I would say, Pandit Ravi Shankar was in almost everything he did musically, because the classical roots and what he had learned from Baba Alauddin Khan Saab, who he acknowledged in every single interview I can ever mm-hmm. remember, those are the roots that really allowed him to be, I would say, a real traditionalist in the sense of his own personal concerts, I mean, and also in his experimentations. So when he was trying to create compositions, I wouldn't really call it fusion in the sense of the word we understand it today. He was mm-hmm. not really a fusionist,
mm-hmm.
but a person who was very interested in taking the idea of raga and trying to see what new colors and dimensions one can bring to that through orchestral tone or timbre, or, you know, contrasts, yeah. where things meet and where things sort of... So that was the fundamental grounding principle of his music making.
He never stopped talking about those 7.5 years of rigorous study of the sitar under Baba Alauddin Khan. He said, Khan told me, Ravi Shankar said, you have to leave everything else and do one thing properly. Rick in Savannah, Georgia is calling. Rick, you're on the air.
Yes, hello, Tom. Thank you for a wonderful program, and a pleasure to hear your wonderful guests speak so eloquently and in detail about Ravi Shankar.
Mm, good. When did you first hear him?
It was probably in the early 70s, but Concert for Bangladesh was the pivotal opening point, perhaps, to my interest in Indian music and the Indian culture.
And where did it send you, this music? What did it open up in you, Rick?
I'm still on the journey. it took me to India, and it just brought a fusion of East and West. And I think quintessentially, that is how I always know and see Ravi Shankar in his homage.
In his own very strongly grounded way. Rick, thank you so much for that from Savannah. Let me get one from Boston, if I may. Mark is calling. Hi, Mark, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you doing?
Very well. What's your experience with Ravi Shankar, Mark?
Well, this is a fantastic thing. He totally transformed and changed my life. I'm a composer who's very involved with Indian music, and I have been my whole life, and I still study it. So first saw him when I was 15 in New Haven, Connecticut. I still have his autograph from the concert. And I think he played Rock Jog on that concert, too, as a matter of fact. And when I first got exposed to this music, it just connected me with something much bigger and larger. But I was also a student of Western classical music and then learning jazz.
Mm-hmm.
So I started seeing the whole picture as something unified. Then I studied sitar for a number of years with Peter Rowe, and I've written a sitar concerto myself that he premiered in Boston many years ago. And I'm very involved with this. I teach classes in it at Berkeley.
Yes.
But I chose to pursue Western music as a performance and composing medium. But Ravi Shankar has been there in my life from the very beginning. First of all, he's one of the three great sitarists of the 20th century,
mm-hmm.
along with Vilayat Khan and Nikhil Banerjee. But the sound of his sitar, the way the jawari is adjusted in particular, really connected with the kind of harmonic and the kind of distortion language of the 60s, interesting, from guitar. So it was a natural fit in that social medium.
What's the freedom that he brought to us, to Western musicians, Mark, if I can put it that way?
Sure. The freedom he brought was to listen to something new done by an absolute master, to hear it on its own terms, and then be able to let it affect you and influence you on many, many levels, whether it was just from the absolute spiritual down to the actual notes you're playing. And in a sense, the music is so universal and so generous that you could hear the real thing, the authentic traditional music, and at the same time see how it connected with creative music from around the world in any context. And in that sense, he uplifted the whole culture of the world. I think he's absolutely one of the greatest musicians that ever lived. And his genius and his ability to transmit this to the world was exceptional.
It does not get bigger than that, and laying the sort of table for the global era we live in. Now, Mark, I'm very glad to hear from you. Well, here's Raga Desi. This is off the 2000 album, Four Ragas. Ravi Shankar. Ken Hunt, Ravi Shankar had a very complicated personal life. He married the daughter of his guru. That marriage eventually was left behind. Americans are now trying to remember how this all happened. His daughter Anushka, kind of heir and collaborator in a lot of his music. We'll hear a little bit of hers. Nora Jones, the daughter of Ravi Shankar, by Sue Jones, an American concert promoter. But they were for some time estranged. What's the relationship, Ken, between Ravi Shankar and these two young women, musicians whose names we know, Nora Jones, his daughter Anushka? What's his relationship in his later years with these two daughters?
Well, I think I should preface that with the fact that with Annapurna Devi, one of the great, great maestros of our time, who was his first wife,
guitar
player.
Mm-hmm.
But they had a son called Shubal,
yes,
who died.
92.
And Shubal played sitar with his father, but his heart was more in popular music in many ways. So it was a tragedy that he died. When it came to Panditji's complicated love life, he wrote in his biography, Ragamala, Garland of Ragas. He seemed to have a girlfriend in many ports, as I think the nautical expression is.
Yes.
So he had a relationship with Sue Jones, Nora's mother.
Mother, yeah.
That was in America. While contemporaneously in Britain, he was having a relationship with Sukanya, who is Anushka's mother.
Yes.
So it does get quite complicated. And when I first interviewed him, it was in London at their house in Wilson Green, and Anushka was there, and she was a sweet thing. She just started learning sitar.
She's learned a lot by now. Here's a little bit from Oceanic Part 1. This is a collaboration between Ravi and Anushka Shankar, father and daughter, for the 2007 album Breathing Underwater. Wonderful. Kartik Seshadri, by the end of this long and amazing life, how did his home country come to see Ravi Shankar, Kartik?
Well, that's a very interesting question, Tom, because the map we have of Pandit Ravi Shankar in the West is quite a different one than the map we have or had of Pandit Ravi Shankar in India. Mm-hmm. I mean, of course, you had the purists who were complaining about the 60s and whatever that is.
Yeah.
But there was a whole other context to him, which was hugely tied into his legacy that came from Baba Alauddin Khan Saab and also his brother-in-law, Ali Akbar Khan Saab, the other great style of sitar playing, Ustad Vilayat Khan Saab. They were considered the musical trinities of the 20th century. Mm. And the map we had of him, and when I met him in the 60s as a child of, you know, six or seven, establishing my own career as a musician. Yes, he came to my home to hear me, and I wanted to meet him. He was not the 60s person we are talking about today, which seems to have become the dominant discourse of Pandit Ravi Shankar in the West. We are always, even today in the interview, as we are talking about him, that seems to take up a large portion of describing him. But the pure aspect of his music has what kept most of the people in India thronging to come and listen to him play concerts that started at 10 o'clock in the night and ended at about 6 or 7 in the morning,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
And that is, those are the memories that really take us back to the very roots of our tradition and the legacy that starts with Baba Alauddin Khan Saab and the Maihar Gharana.
When you're as big as Ravi Shankar, your legacy may have many faces. It is enormous. Grateful to the two of you for being with us today. Kartik Seshadri joining us from the University of California, San Diego. Thank you very much. I'm sorry for the loss of this guru and teacher of yours, but thank you for being with us today.
Thank you. Pleasure being here.
And Ken Hunt in England, you're very generous with your time. Our same sympathies and gratitude to you for joining us. Thank you so much, Ken.
A pleasure. There's so much more to talk about.
Yes, yes. Another time. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.